We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And away we go, episode 90 of the Al Galdi podcast, the Kennard Lang episode. Is it too early to call it the Montez Sweat episode? I'll let you decide. In any event, it is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021, the day after, easily, the most tension-filled game so far this national season. And there was tension for a variety of reasons. Tension because this was game one of a big two-game series for the Nats at the Philadelphia Phillies. Tension because this was yet another meeting for the Nats with their old pal, Bryce Harper, who homered on Tuesday night. Tension because Max Scherzer was making his return from the 10-day injured list and dueling with Zach Wheeler. Tension because Max got checked not once, not twice, but three times for illegal substances, a.k.a. the sticky stuff, and ultimately got into it with Joe Girardi, as did Davey Martinez. Girardi ended up being ejected. Tension because the Nats won by just one run, 3-2, and despite Brad Hand loading the bases with one out in the bottom of the ninth. If you like drama, if you like conflict, you had all of that and then some on Tuesday night. What a game. So much to get into. And you know that we will get into all of it in fine fashion on this show. A show that always know goes in depth on all four of the big four in DC sports. The Washington Football Team, the Nationals, the Capitals, and the Wizards. But hello and welcome to another installment of the Al Galdi podcast. Lots on the Washington Football Team for you on this installment of the pod. Special guest, Washington all-time great Joe Theismann. Yes, Joe Theismann. What, the third best quarterback in franchise history, right? Sammy Ball and Sonny Jurgensen are 1-2 in some order after those two. Who you putting ahead of Joe? He'll be with me to talk Washington Football Team, including a ton on the quarterback situation. What does Joe think of the quarterback competition that Ron Rivera keeps talking up? Is Joe bullish on Ryan Fitzpatrick? What does Joe think that Washington may have in Taylor Heinicke? Does Joe have a theory for why Ron isn't including Kyle Allen in the quarterback competition? The answers to all of those questions are forthcoming. Also, I have some scheduled fun for you next segment involving George Allen and Jim Zorn. Yes, scheduled fun. Because the only thing better in life than spontaneous fun is scheduled fun. I have some thoughts for you on the Wizards, on them not being a participant in the NBA draft lottery on Tuesday night. Knowing what you now know, would you swap the Wizards having made the playoffs this season for being in the draft lottery on Tuesday night? And I will properly commemorate what the Orioles achieved on Tuesday night, their 50th loss of the season. Yes, halfway already to another 100 lost season. That, my friends, is how you tank. The O's are redefining what it means to tank. Why lose 100 when you can lose 110? Well, you could say that the Orioles have become masters of the tank. just like our guy John Grandland of Real Broker is a master of selling homes. If someone is as good at his or her job as the Orioles are at losing, you know that that person is really good at his or her job, and nobody will do a better job of selling your home than my guy, John Grandland, a.k.a. John G. And never forget, he offers commission flex. Ron Rivera has position flex. John Grandland has commission flex.
Position flex.
Yes, Ron, you have position flex. John G. has commission flex. You see, not every home requires the same amount of work or money spent marketing. So why should you pay the same fees? Why should there be this flat, unadjustable commission that you have to pay to your real estate agent? It doesn't make sense. It's never made sense. Don't accept that. If your house is going to sell in 6 minutes, don't pay 6%. Let John Grandland put a marketing plan together for you that will maximize your home's value and help you keep more of your hard-earned equity in your pocket. John has a menu of commission packages that you can choose from, including selling your home for free. Yes, you heard that right. For free, some conditions apply. Interviewing John Grandland is an absolute no-brainer. He can come by your house, give you a step-by-step plan on what to do to get top dollar, and maybe even more importantly, what not to do so you don't spend needlessly, and there is never any obligation to list or sell. Attention to detail, deep understanding of the market, great personality. John Grandland brings to the table everything that you would want in a real estate agent. Do yourself a favor and call John Grandland. He will sell your home guaranteed. That's right, guaranteed. He guarantees the sale of your home. Call John G at 703-537-6747. Make sure you tell him that Al Galdi sent you. That's 703-537-6747. Or visit johngsellsforfree.com. That's johngsellsforfree.com. John Grandland. Nobody will do a better job of selling your home. And remember, he is the master of commission flex.
Position flex.
That's right, Ron. Just like position flex. All right, my conversation with Joe Theismann talking Washington football team is coming up next segment. You can always email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. I, on Sunday evening, received an email from Chris Abase, who wrote, quote, short notice, but 2 1-hour shows about George Allen's Redskins air on NFL Network at 7:30 p.m. tonight. I'm just glad to see Redskins in one of the show titles. End quote. I had no idea that NFL Network was doing this, so thank you, Chris, for the email. And the piece that aired at 7:30 turned out to be the NFL Films documentary on the 1971 Redskins titled Three Cheers for the Redskins. Now, I am 41. My first season as a Skins fan was the 1987 season. So yes, what a glorious way to begin my fandom. And so the George Allen Skins teams of the 1970s were before I was born. My knowledge of them is from what I've read and heard and seen. And when it comes to what I've seen about George Allen Skins teams, that's all about NFL Films. NFL Films is the best. It has been invaluable regarding the growth of the NFL. I'm sure many of you listening experienced the George Allen Skins teams of the 1970s. I did not. So I get a lot out of these NFL Films pieces. Well, this one on the 1971 team, again titled Three Cheers for the Redskins. And no, NFL Network did not censor the word Redskins, although knowing the way our world works, expect that to change sometime soon. But anyway, this piece titled Three Cheers for the Redskins featured the famous George Allen clip of him doing, wait for it, three cheers for the Skins. George Allen was Washington's head coach from 1971 through 1977. Each of his seven seasons was a winning season. He had a regular season winning percentage as Washington head coach of 691, which is absurd. He is not the greatest head coach in Washington history. That man, of course, is Joe Gibbs, but George Allen is an excellent number two. And the fact that his son Bruce had the tenure that he had with Washington as an executive really is something, because his dad is and forever will be revered.
It means you're close.
Yes. Hello, Brucey. Anyway, the 1971 season, it was George Allen's first season as Washington head coach. Washington began the season with a 24-17 win at the St. Louis Cardinals. After the win, this was George Allen in the locker room with his players.
Yeah! Let's have three cheers for the Redskins. Hip, hip! You did. You beat them in their own backyard. You came from behind, and we showed we got some character. Next week, we get those goddamn Giants.
Okay, so there is so much that is so great about that clip. First of all, I am perpetually a mark for NFL postgame locker room celebration videos. I always get a kick out of those. A team having won its battle, celebrating together. I think that's awesome. But that right there had to be the first instance of George Allen doing three cheers for the Redskins, right? That was his first regular season game as Washington head coach. When else would he have done three cheers for the Redskins up until that point? And that became a famous thing with George Allen. Three cheers for the Redskins. Hip, hip, hooray. So much so, and this is the kicker, that none other than Jim Zorn tried to bring back the three cheers for the Redskins. Yes, Jim Zorn, the Zorn star, old Zorny. As bad as his tenure as Washington head coach ended up being, never forget that Zorn began that tenure 6-2 in the regular season. Zorn was Washington's head coach for two seasons, 2008 and 2009. He started off 6-2, then went 6-18 in the regular season the rest of his tenure. But it was during that 6-2 start that Zorn, after a Washington win, brought back the three cheers for the Redskins, or at least tried to. Here you go.
I want to say three cheers. It's going to be a hip hip, and I want a hooray. Okay, three cheers. Hip hip,
hooray!
Hip hip,
hooray!
Hip hip, hooray!
All right, so the players were into it with Zorn, although I love how he tries to act all hard at the beginning of that and goes, "It's going to be a hip hip, and I want a hooray." And it's like, "Okay, okay, coach, whatever you say."
It's going to be a hip hip, and I want a hooray. Okay.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But hip hip hooray from Jim Zorn. I mean, is that not as corny as it gets? Corny Zorny doing the hip hip hooray. I mean, hip hip hooray was probably plenty corny in 1971. By 2008, forget about it. And yet, the Zorn star tried to bring that back. That is classic. The other thing about that George Allen cut, though, is what he said about the Giants. Washington's Week 2 game in the 1971 season was a game at the Giants. Washington won that game 33. I just love how Allen matter-of-factly says, next week, we get those GD Giants. You know, just said so perfectly in that epic George Allen way. That cracked me up. Here it is again.
Next week, we get those goddamn Giants.
Yeah, next week, we get those GD Giants.
Next week, we get those goddamn Giants.
Exactly. Remind me to play that as a drop prior to Washington's two games against the Giants this coming season. Washington faces the Giants at FedEx Field on Thursday Night Football in Week 2. Ah, Week 2, just like in the 1971 season. And Washington is at the Giants in Week 18 in Washington's regular season finale. Hopefully we'll have the one seed in the NFC locked up by then, but we have a lot of separation between Washington's two games against the Giants this coming season. So we got to remember to play that drop. And so on this Wednesday, a salute to the skies in honor of George Allen, a man for whom I have increased appreciation of what I saw in that documentary over the last few days. Thank you again, Chris, for alerting me to that. Well, a man who is worthy of a hip, another hip, and then a hooray is one of the great supporters of this podcast, Dr. George Verghese, the medical director for the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland. He is a board-certified dermatologist and Mohs surgeon. The Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland focuses on medical dermatology and skin cancer diagnosis and comprehensive care, including something very special and cutting-edge, superficial radiation therapy, or SRT. SRT is an alternative to surgical procedures for basal cell and squamous cell skin cancers. SRT is revolutionary. It's a non-surgical skin cancer treatment that's safe and effective. You see, having skin cancer doesn't mean having to have surgery and the downtime and side effects that go with surgery. You have options. Understand that a non-surgical option in SRT is available, and Dr. George Verghese in the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland offer SRT, unlike many other dermatology practices in the area, and SRT is covered by most insurances. To find out more, call 301-396-3401. Make sure you tell them that Al Galdi sent you. That phone number again, 301-396-3401, or visit midatlanticskin.com. That's midatlanticskin.com. Dr. George Verghese in the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland, nationally recognized for treating skin cancer across the Mid-Atlantic region.
Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray!
All right, so inside of 5 weeks now are we from the start of Washington football team training camp. A lot has happened this offseason. Very pleased to welcome to the Al Galdi podcast right now Washington all-time great quarterback Joe Theismann, the Associated Press MVP of the 1983 regular season, Super Bowl 17 champion, the author of a terrific book, How to Be a Champion Every Day, Six Timeless Keys to Success, as we're in the midst of summer. Perhaps you are looking for some summer reading. Joe, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm great, Al. Thank you very much for having me on. I look forward to it. I enjoy your podcast, so it's a pleasure to be with you.
I appreciate you coming on, and you're going to be participating in the American Century Golf Tournament coming up in Lake Tahoe, correct?
Yes, that's on July 9th through 11th. It'll be on NBC, NBCSN, and Golf Channel. You know, Justin Timberlake, Aaron Rodgers, Fitz is going to be there. Ryan Fitzpatrick will be there as well. Just a varied group of people. We have some great women golfers. Annika Sorenstam is going to play again this year. And one thing that's great about it, American Century is the sponsor. And American Century does something very unique in the world of business, is they donate over 40% of their profits to the Stauer Institute to do research on diseases. And I mean, it's just, they've been doing it for years. They've donated over $1.7 billion over the years. It's $5.5 million that's been raised for the local charities up in Lake Tahoe and other charities. So it's not only a great chance for us to be able to compete, because we're all competition junkies, especially those of us that have been away from the game for so long, but it's for such a great cause. Of course, Charles Barkley will be there, Ray Romano. Just the list goes, Larry the Cable Guy, the list goes on and on and on.
Outstanding. Sounds like a great event. So I wanted to have you on to get your thoughts on where we are with Washington, with the offseason, you know, mostly complete. Overall, do you like what Washington has done this offseason?
I really do. First, it starts with the draft. Well, it starts actually with free agency. I think we've added some speed to the wide receiving core, which I think is terrific. Adding Fitz, again, gives you a veteran in the meeting room when it comes to playing the position. I believe he'll be the starter. You know, Taylor gets a chance to continue to grow and go. You know, the quarterback position, if we're lucky, you know, you get a guy for 8, 9, 10 years. So how much longer can Fitz go? And of course, with Kyle and Taylor there, you've got guys that are familiar with the system. I think in the secondary, we've added the corner. You drafted the really, really terrific linebacker out of Kentucky, Jamin. So, I mean, if you look at what's been done in the offseason from a player addition standpoint, I think we filled and checked every box that everybody talked about. Offensive lineman Eric Flowers is back. You made some changes. Obviously, Morgan is gone, and Nick's gone as far as the center, Nick Sundberg. Ryan is on to Philadelphia. But they were getting to a point where they had to make decisions everywhere you went. And one thing that I've been looking at, Al, which is curious, is you look at the money that a lot of teams are paying quarterbacks. You combine all of our quarterbacks, they don't even come to half of what some of the other teams are playing. So it gives you some wiggle room there. And, you know, the last couple of years, Fitz has played some darn good football. Matter of fact, you know, they took him – they took the job away from him in Miami only because they wanted to give it to Tua, not because Fitz wasn't playing well. So, you know, he sort of is coming off of a good year for as limited as it was, and got a chance to stay very healthy during that period of time. And when they needed him, he stepped in and did a yeoman's effort. But I really, really like the way that this football team's been put together. And the most impressive thing about the offseason is every guy showed up at the mini camps and the OTAs. This is a football team that's hungry. This is a football team that wants to be able to play and wants to be able to win. And that's a culture created by Ron Rivera.
With Ryan Fitzpatrick, you're so right. He has played well the last few seasons. I feel like he doesn't always get credit for that. Assuming that he is Washington's starting quarterback, what do you see Fitzpatrick bringing to Washington's offense?
I think he brings veteran leadership. He brings stability. He brings a knowledge of the game. He's certainly a great competitor. I mean, he's exciting and fun to watch. You know, maybe he doesn't run around like a Kyler Murray, but he moves around enough to get you where you'll hold your breath and go, wow, that was unbelievable. He's not afraid to make throws, has great anticipation when it comes to delivering the ball. And with this young receiving core, I think it's exciting. The growth of Logan Thomas will be interesting to see how that grows. But I think Fitz is going to be a guy that this football team is going to look at and say, that's the leader of our football team. He's going to step in a huddle, and guys are going to pay attention. There's not going to be a question mark as to what he's going to do or why it happened. And he's unflappable. So he brings all those things to the table.
It is interesting, and it's become impossible to ignore. Ron Rivera lately has very much been talking up a quarterback competition, and he's framing the competition as a two-man battle, Ryan Fitzpatrick versus Taylor Heinicke. What do you make of that?
And it's right. Taylor put on 15 pounds. I think that was one of the goals that he wanted to accomplish, was to get bigger so that he could take the abuse that you take at the position. He's still, because he runs a lot, he moves around a lot, so he takes a little more hits than a lot of people do. It'll be a competition. And this is the thing that Ron, when he got the job here a few years back, the thing he wanted to create was competition. I mean, there's competition to play in the defensive line. As good as we have a defensive line, there's still competition to play. Matt Ioannidis, Tim Settle, Deron Payne, Jonathan Allen. I mean, you can only play so many guys. And so when you look at the additions to this football team and you think of what Ron wanted to create, there's going to be competition at the wide receiver position. It's going to be every route you run, every catch you make and or drop. Those are things that are going to be impactful in the evaluation process of what the guys want to do. But the one thing Ron wanted to create was competition. And he admits to the one mistake that he made. And it wasn't his fault last year when Dwayne wound up being the starter without ever having any competition, because there was no place to have competition. So he went with the guy that was here. And that was, Ron says, well, I don't believe it was a mistake at all. I believe circumstances forced him to do what he needed to do. But now, and I think, Taylor's going to compete. He's got to be excited about the opportunity to be able to go out there and compete. Fitz is, 38 years old, for goodness sakes. And he's a young kid that's got a sampling of the game. He showed some really great flashes in the five quarters that he's played. Now it's a chance to be able to show more of what he can do, and maybe be the quarterback of the future of this football team.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, like you said, it's only five quarters, but geez, I mean, he played so well in that playoff loss to Tampa Bay. He does have the injury history, but he's put on the 15 pounds. He knows Scott Turner's offense very well. What do you think Washington could have in Taylor Heinicke?
I think the one word that comes to my mind, and it's the one thing we haven't had, and that is stability, Al. We've had no stability. Coaching instability has created issues, but quarterback instability is crazy. Since I got hurt, just as a reference, since I got hurt in 1985, I believe we have had 37 or 38 different starting quarterbacks, and Fitz will be another new one. Now, that's absurd.
Yeah.
In 35 years, you get 35 different quarterbacks. I mean, if you really want to have some fun one day with your podcast, go through the list of quarterbacks that have played and started here in the last 35 years.
Please, no. Yeah.
No, but I'm saying, throw the names out. See how many people recognize the names.
Yeah.
And I mean, these are one-game starts, four-game starts, three-game starts. This is how ridiculous it is, and I don't say this to toot my horn, just to put in perspective the stability that we haven't had there. I am second all-time in starts, consecutive starts at 99. Now, you think of the Green Bay Packers with Brett and Aaron. You think of the 49ers with Joe and Steve. You look at the organizations that have been able to really compete on a consistent basis. You have to have stability at that position. So that's the thing I think we can look at with Taylor. He understands the game. He's not going to make the stupid mistakes. He'll continue to grow in that position, and it's a process. But I think stability is the one thing I think about with him that could possibly happen.
We're talking Washington football team with Washington all-time great quarterback Joe Theismann. It does stand out that Ron, in continually talking up the quarterback competition, is not bringing up Kyle Allen. Ron has been very clear. This is a two-man battle, Fitzpatrick versus Heinicke. Ron last December was very complimentary of Kyle. There was a famous exchange in which Ron got asked, would you be here if not for Alex Smith? And Ron said yes, if Kyle Allen had not gotten hurt, essentially saying Kyle could have gotten Washington to where Alex did.
Sure.
Why do you think Ron isn't including Kyle in the quarterback competition?
Well, because there's not enough time, Al. I mean, this is different. I mean, I'll take you back to the ancient times of football, okay? the ancient days of football, 1974. We had 6 preseason games. Heck, I went to camp on the 4th of July, and the games and the season didn't start till September. And, you know, when I came here, it was Billy and Sonny's job, and I was the third guy. If I'm Kyle Allen, I'm a sponge. I'm under the radar. I'm going to work on my game. I'm going to work on keeping myself healthy. I'm going to stay after practice and work on the routes that I need to. I'm going to show the coaches that I want to be prepared. I want to be ready. Because let's face what 2 years ago, we went through 4 quarterbacks?
Mm-hmm.
Or just a year ago, we went through a number of them? You just never know. But he is another one that's familiar with the system. He's coming off of a pretty severe injury. So to say he's going to be in there doesn't really make sense. And the other thing we have to appreciate and I think love about Ron Rivera is he's honest. You know, what you see is what you get. There's no politics here. There's no BS. This is the way he sees it. This is the way it's going to be. Guys, this is what you're looking at. Now, is it going to wind up not having Kyle get a chance to compete? No. He'll probably get a chance to play at least one of the preseason games because the guys aren't going to play a lot in preseason. So he'll get a chance to show what he can do. He'll get a chance to show what he can build on. And again, I think, you know, you have someone who's familiar with the system, but you don't have enough snaps to make it a 3-man competition. You know, you've got to get Ryan Fitzpatrick ready because he needs as many snaps as he can get because he hasn't had any. Taylor Heinicke, as we said, played 5 quarters. So you have to get him snaps. You haven't had any really in the OTAs. You haven't been able to hit. You haven't been able to really have 11 on 11s. Minicamp was so short. You had a limited period of time. You're going to be in Richmond for 4 days. Then you're going to be back to the facility in Ashburn. So time doesn't permit you to create a 3-man competition.
If you're Ron, do you give Heinicke first-team reps in camp, or do you give all of those reps to Fitzpatrick?
I'd give some to Taylor. But again, what do you call the first team? Because there's competition in the offensive line. There's competition at the wide receiver position. There's competition at the running back position. So I would probably give Ryan more work than Taylor. But who are you going to call the starting offensive line? Not on paper, but who's actually going to be there?
Right. Yeah.
So if you really it's a great question, but I think the answer is we don't know what's going to happen around that position to say, okay, these are the other 10 guys that are starters. Are they really? Maybe there's 3 or 4 guys on quote unquote the second team that are going to wind up being starters. So there's competition everywhere. Taylor's going to get his chance to work with quote unquote the ones. But Ryan probably should get the brunt of the work because he's not as familiar with the system. Although, you know, he's such a smart guy. He can pick it up in a heartbeat. And this is the system that I played in. So the verbiage and the terminology, I think, is going to be one of the simpler ones that he's had a chance to play in. It gets complex by adding things. For example, it's a numbering system. So let's just use the number 989. Okay, so that tells the 3 immediate receivers what they do: tight end, outside receiver, split end. Okay, and then you start tagging on things: 989, H post, R swing, X check down, Y flat. I mean, so you can make it as long as you want, but you're telling each position what to do.
I do want to get your takes on a few non-quarterback items. So something that became a topic a few weeks ago was Chase Young no-showing the OTA practices. Now, the OTA practices are voluntary, but Chase Young, of course, is a really good player. He became a captain for Washington late last season. There was a lot of thought of, hey, you know, couldn't he have found the time to show up for these 2 weeks of OTA practices? I mean, he was well within his rights not to show up to the OTA practices, but there is an argument of, you know, as a leader, why couldn't he have been there? What's your stance on that?
I got no problem whatsoever. You know what you're going to get out of Chase Young. I mean, the fact that he had other commitments and took care of some things that he wanted to take care of and needed to take care of, I have no problem whatsoever with what Chase did. And I have no problem to know that he's going to show up and play his heart out every Sunday, every Monday, every Thursday, every whenever. I just, you know, I mean, it was the off season. He's a terrific young man, a terrific young athlete, and I had no problem with him taking the voluntary time off. But he, you know, he was at minicamp, and he was there when he's supposed to be there. And he's been there at times when it was an option for him not to have to be there. So I didn't have any problem whatsoever with it, Al.
What do you make of the schedule so backloaded with NFC East games? Each of Washington's final five games is a division game. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's great. I think it's great, especially in our division where you know, the Giants, you know, look like they got a little bit better. You know, Philly is not quite sure exactly what they're going to be. Dallas thinks, you know, thinks he got Dak coming back off the leg, and they feel like they got better with what they did. We got better, I think, what we did. I think it isn't just us. Look at every team in the National Football League. Every schedule now is backloaded. The NFL did this so that they wanted to make those games, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17, interesting. And they wanted them to have meaning. And that's exactly what they've done. I mean, we've got a tough schedule. I mean, you get Tampa Bay, you know, you get Kansas City, you know, you get division champions, you get San Diego. I mean, you get good football teams. You're traveling. And at the end, you sort of get a chance to look. To me, I always look at when the bye is. You know, Tampa hasn't lost since their bye last year because they figured out who they were offensively and what they wanted to be. Defensively, they were set. Offensively, they had some things to figure out. I always look at where the bye falls. If the bye falls somewhere in the middle, it's a great break for a team to get healthy and reload. If the break comes too early, you know, you've got a very long season you're looking at. So for us, I think the bye is important, but I'm excited about the back end. Because if you want to win the division, you got to beat all those teams.
Well, and what's also interesting with that is Ron Rivera historically does his best work late in seasons. His record as Carolina Panthers head coach in regular season games in November, December, and January was great. We saw how well Washington did last season as the season went on. So if that holds true, Washington should be able to feast on all these NFC East opponents late in the season. All right, final topic for you. Everyone has an opinion on what the permanent name of the Washington football team should be. What is Joe Theismann's opinion on what the permanent name should be?
You're going to love this. I have no opinion. Obviously I played for the Washington Redskins. We won championships under that name. Now we're the Washington football team. I think we will have a new name. I hope we have a new name. I just don't want to be the Washington football team. I hope we do have a new name going forward. There's been a myriad of them submitted. I haven't really given it a whole lot of thought. Whatever it's going to be, I'm excited for the young guys because they're going to now create their own legacy under a different name. You know, this one's sort of this is one of those interim names, let's call it, the interim name until the final one is named. But I think Washington has done the right thing, taking the time to solicit alumni, solicit fans, marketing people, figure out what's not going to upset somebody the most. Because, you know, somebody's going to be pissed out. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And in society today, somebody's going to be upset with something. So they're taking their time. And I think it's smart the way they've gone about it. But I tell you, whatever we're called, whoever we are, I think, and you know me, I'm very cautiously optimistic, but I am very optimistic about this football team this year. I think we're going to be fun. I think we're going to be extremely competitive. And I think fans are going to get a real treat out of this football team to watch them work.
I'm with you. I share in your optimism. Well, I always enjoy talking Washington football team with you. I appreciate your time. And best of luck in Lake Tahoe.
Thanks, Al. Take care.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well, what a night for the Nationals in Philadelphia on Tuesday. A 9-inning game that took 3 hours, 52 minutes, featured Max Scherzer being checked for illegal substances 3 times, featured Davey Martinez yelling at Joe Girardi, featured Joe Girardi yelling at Max Scherzer, featured Joe Girardi getting ejected, featured Brad Hand walking the tightrope like few relievers ever will, but ultimately registering a 4-out save, featured Bryce Harper homering, and oh yeah, featured the Nats winning for a 10th time in 13 games. For all of the drama on Tuesday night, the Nats continue to surge. The Nats won at the Phillies 3-2. The New York Mets lost to the Atlanta Braves 3-0. So the Nats now are in a 3-way tie for second place in the National League East with the Phillies and Braves, each team 4 games behind the division-leading Mets. And so, Davey Martinez, if you would please.
I'm proud of the boys.
Yes, sir, Davey. What a game and what a night. Let us begin with the sticky stuff. As if Tuesday night wasn't big enough for Max Scherzer, the Nats on Tuesday reinstated Max from the 10-day injured list, which he'd been on since June 15th, retroactive to June 12th, with groin inflammation. Max was dueling with Zach Wheeler, who's having an excellent season for the Phillies, until Tuesday night anyway. This was the first game for the Nats since MLB began enhanced enforcement of rules prohibiting applying foreign substances to baseball. So there was a lot going on for Max Scherzer on Tuesday night. Initially, the random checks of are you using illegal sticky stuff or aren't you were kind of fun and not that big of a deal. I mean, we know a lot of pitchers are not happy about this, and there is a much larger conversation, and we've had it on the podcast, of why the heck is MLB doing this mid-season, all of a sudden deciding to enforce rules that have been on the books for years? You know, this is another instance of MLB being reactive as opposed to proactive. But, you know, initially, it was just kind of a funny deal. Max Scherzer, right after the end of the bottom of the first, got checked for the first time by the umpires. And the result was a potentially all-time great meme, or meme, if you're Bryce Harper. This annoyed and disgusted look on Max's face and with his body language while being checked by the umpires. Remember, Max has a significant role with the MLB Players Association, so part of this was theater on Max's part, but okay, you know, kind of a funny moment, Max getting checked for the first time, haha. Then came the second time that Max got checked. There really wasn't much to that. That happened right after the bottom of the third. Then came the third time. The third time is the charm. Remember, you can be checked at random by umpires, but the opposing manager can also request that a pitcher be checked for the sticky stuff. And this is what happened with one out in the bottom of the fourth inning. Phillies manager Joe Girardi called for Max to get checked for a third time after he struck out Alec Bohm for the first out. And Max was not happy about this. He angrily threw his hat on the ground. He unbuckled his belt as if he was about to take his pants off to say, hey, go ahead and check me right here. Davey Martinez came out to the mound, started yelling at Girardi, who pretty clearly was trying to mess with Max. Now, let me say this. I actually don't blame Girardi for doing this. I actually think what Girardi did makes a lot of sense. Now, you're not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to use these checks for illegal substances as gamesmanship things. But that doesn't mean that managers aren't going to try to do that sort of a thing. And I think that was precisely what Joe Girardi was doing. And then came Girardi ultimately being ejected. That happened right after the bottom of the fifth, of him coming out of the dugout to scream at Max, who gave Girardi a death stare while walking back to the dugout. So in other words, bottom of the fifth ends, Max is walking back toward the dugout and is just eyeballing, is just mean mugging Girardi while Joe's in the dugout. Joe sees this, and if you know Joe Girardi, you know, I mean, the guy played forever. Joe Girardi is all jacked up too, so he's, you know, he's one of these, you know, testosterone-laden managers. And he comes out of the dugout and he starts screaming at Max. Joe ends up getting ejected for all of this. So this is very much a thing. Max versus Joe, Davey versus Joe. Here was some of Max during his post-game press conference on what went down with Girardi and what was going on with Max and all these checks for, again, the sticky stuff.
Obviously, Girardi, you know, for me, it's, you know, kind of confusing. If you watch the bomb at bat, I mean, I almost put a 95 mile an hour fastball on his head because the ball slipped out of my hand. You know, the whole night I was sick of kind of licking my fingers and tasting rosin the whole night. So the only part, I couldn't even get sweat from the back of my head because it wasn't really a warm night. So for me, the only part that was sweaty on me was actually my hair. So I had to take off my hat to be able to try to get any type of, you know, try to get some type of moisture on my hand, to try to, you know, mix with the rosin. And so, you know, for me, that's the confusing part, is I'm just trying to get a grip of the ball. And you can even watch in that previous at bat, the ball slipped out of my hand, almost drilled somebody in the face.
Yeah, so Girardi's reason for the check of Max, at least what Girardi said was the reason, was that Max kept going to his head, to his hat. And Joe was like, hey, that's sketchy. You guys got to check him out. And Max right there laid out why he kept going to his head slash hat, because he needed something to better grip the baseball. See, this is part of the argument with this sticky stuff is that pitchers actually need this stuff to better control baseballs. And so the idea here should have been address it in the offseason and try to come up with some universal substance that isn't going to doctor baseballs too much, but is going to allow for pitchers to properly grip baseballs so that they have adequate control of where those baseballs are going. As Max detailed, that plate appearance by Bohm nearly resulted in disaster. You know, Bohm getting nailed by a Max Scherzer pitch. Here was some more from Max.
For me, it's when you look at how the game unfolded, and you specifically that at bat, you know, I don't think I'd have to be an absolute fool to actually use something tonight when everybody's intent is out of, you know, everybody's intent is, you know, so far high to look for anything. So, you know, it is what it is, whatever. Turn the page, move on.
MLB's got a real mess with this situation, and I don't blame MLB for trying to crack down on the usage of illegal substances. Clearly that's been going on, but see, here's the problem. It's been going on for years, and it's just now that MLB decides to do something. This is exactly like the PED problem. You know, these rules that MLB is enhancing enforcement of, these rules have been on the books forever. And MLB has just now decided, oh yeah, maybe we should enforce these rules. That's a problem, especially when you decide mid-season to start enforcing these things. Why couldn't this have been addressed during the offseason? Why couldn't you have maybe talked to the players and said, okay, what's the best way to do this? You're not going to dictate how we do this, but we do value your input on this. And maybe there is some universal substance we can come up with here. Because as things stand right now, there is no substance you're allowed to use. You can only use the dopey rosin bag. That's it. And as Max Scherzer was explaining there, the rosin bag isn't good enough. Now look, Max is a biased participant. He is someone who, like I said, has a role with the Players Association. The Players Association loves to whine and complain about every little thing. So I understand that. But man, MLB could not have rolled this out in like a clumsier way. And that in game one, not game, you know, 15, game one of the Nationals being subjected to this enhanced enforcement of, again, already existing rules, you get the mess that we ended up getting on Tuesday night. Well, when it came to Max Scherzer's pitching performance, he ended up only going for 5 innings. Now, he pitched well, all things considered, but he threw a ton of pitches. Max lasted for just 5 innings due to throwing 106 pitches. You do wonder, to what extent was that a result of him not being able to use whatever he had been using to better grip baseballs. But like I said, overall, Max was good. One run in five innings on eight strikeouts versus just two hits, which were a homer and a double. He did issue three walks, but he threw 70 strikes versus 36 balls. The problem, again, was that Max threw a lot of pitches. Max, in a perfect bottom of the first, struck out the side in Odubel Herrera, Rhys Hoskins, and JT Realmuto. That's good, but strikeouts require a lot of pitches. Max gave up a run in the bottom of the second on, yes, a leadoff homer by the ex-Nat Bryce Harper on a 1-2 pitch. Max then issued a full count walk to Andrew McCutchen and a one-out eight-pitch walk to Brad Miller, but got out of the inning without giving up any more runs. But still, right, you give up the homer, then you issue a couple of walks, so that drives up the pitch count. Max, in a scoreless bottom of the third, struck out Harper on six pitches with a runner on second and two outs. So obviously it's good to have Max back. You would have liked for him to have lasted for more than the five innings. But what everyone is talking about, and this is a big deal not just locally but nationally, this was all over the place on Twitter on Tuesday night, Max and the sticky stuff and what went down between Max and Joe Girardi, and to a lesser extent, Davey Martinez and Joe Girardi. So the Nats bullpen got used quite a bit on Tuesday night. The Nats' corresponding roster move, by the way, on Tuesday to reinstating Max from the 10-day injured list was placing a key reliever, Kyle Finnegan, on the 10-day IL with a left hamstring strain. Kyle's placement on the IL retroactive to June 21st. Davey ended up using three relievers in the 3-2 win at the Phillies on Tuesday night. Those three relievers combined to allow one run in four innings. So overall, another good outing for the bullpen, but it wasn't easy. And if you watch the game, you know of what I speak. So Austin Voth was the first guy out of the pen, and he was good. Two scoreless innings, perfect bottom of the sixth, had two strikeouts, a three-pitch strikeout of Bryce Harper for the first out, and a strikeout of Alec Bohm for the third out. Then Tanner Rainey came into the game. He faced three batters in the bottom of the eighth, sandwiched strikeouts of Odubel Herrera and JT Realmuto around a boo-boo. Rainey gave up a one-out solo homer to Rhys Hoskins on a 1-2 pitch. And then came the adventures of Brad Hand. Brad Hand ultimately tossed 1 1/3 scoreless innings. But man, it was not easy. He threw 34 pitches to get the four outs. Hand entered the game in the bottom of the eighth with two outs, the bases empty, and the Nats nursing a 3-2 lead. He gave up a two-out single to Harper, did then, though, strike out Andrew McCutchen in a beautiful display of pitching. Hand got the strikeout on McCutchen on five pitches for the third out, off McCutchen having been ahead in the count, 2-0. The last two strikes in the plate appearance were called strikes. That was a masterful job of Brad Hand, going from McCutchen being up 2-0 to ultimately striking out McCutchen with, again, the last two strikes being called strikes. Then came Hand tossing a scoreless bottom of the ninth inning despite loading the bases with one out. He gave up a leadoff double to Alec Bohm, a one-out hit-by-pitch of Ronald Torres, despite him having been down in the count at 1.12, and a one-out infield single by pinch hitter Matt Vierling, despite him having been down in the count at 1.02. Trey Turner was unable to make the play on that infield single. But Hand did then come through. It took forever. That bottom of the ninth felt like it took about 4 hours, but Hand did deliver. He retired the final two batters he faced, including Odubel Herrera on a flyout in shallow left field on a putout that was made by Josh Harrison, despite him crashing into Trey Turner. Josh Harrison had to move from second base to left field, as Davey these days is not trusting Kyle Schwarber in the latter innings of games. Schwarber's been dealing with a problematic knee, and so Schwarber got pulled from the game for defensive purposes. Harrison got moved over to left field, and I would think, at least in part because of the lack of playing time for Harrison in left field, you had a communication breakdown, and he crashed into Trey Turner, and that was a frightening scene. Trey Turner lay on the ground for a while after that. You didn't know if he would be able to stay in the game. He did, thankfully, and said after the game that he'll be good to go for game two in the series Wednesday afternoon at 1:05, but that could have been disastrous. Thankfully, it was not. Hand walked the tightrope, to be sure. I mean, again, bases loaded, one out, you're nursing a 3-2 lead, but Brad Hand ultimately got the job done. And of course, this was another game in which the Nats only scored three runs. Like, it shouldn't have had to be that tight, but it was, because the Nats couldn't score more than the three runs. Now, I do want to credit the Nats for this. They did get to the Philly starting pitcher, Zach Wheeler, who's having an excellent season. Wheeler entered the game with an ERA of 2.15 and an ERA plus of 182 on the season. And know this too, Wheeler entered the game with a National League leading 96 and a third innings over 14 starts this season. So Wheeler is a guy who had been pitching really well and lasting fairly deep anyway into games. And what happened on Tuesday night? The Nats drove Wheeler out of the game after just three innings. The Nats got to Wheeler to the tune of three runs in three innings, forced him to throw 73 pitches. That's a good job by the Nats, who, of course, have not done so well against high-level pitching so far this season, did do well against Wheeler on Tuesday night. But that was kind of it offensively. The Nats for the game, just three runs on nine hits and two walks. The Nats scored the three runs on three RBI singles. Now, the Nats did go 3-for-10 with runners in scoring position, but, you know, this is another game in which you don't score a lot. And when you do score, it's on the backs of singles. You know, not a bunch of homers or doubles or anything like that. Just a bunch of singles. Yan Gomes, number five batter, 2-for-4 with two RBI singles. He had a one-out full count RBI single in a Nats two-run first. Had a two-out RBI single on a 1-2 pitch in the top of the third. Josh Bell, cleanup batter, went 1-for-4. Had a one-out RBI single in the Nats two-run first. Juan Soto, as the number three batter, had a couple of singles, 2-for-5, had a one-out full-count single in the Nats two-run first, a one-out single and a stolen base in the Nats one-run third. But otherwise, there wasn't much happening offensively for the Nats on Tuesday night. Kyle Schwarber was again the leadoff batter, 1-for-5 with a couple of strikeouts, had a one-out single in the top of the fourth, despite having been down in the count of 1.12. Trey Turner, as the number two batter, went 0-for-4 with a walk, left three men on base. He had a one-out seven-pitch walk in that Nats two-run first, despite having been down in that count at 1.02. Starlin Castro had a double on Tuesday night. That was good, a two-out double in the top of the third, but he also failed in a big spot, struck out on five pitches with runners on first and second and one out in the top of the first. He also committed a fielding error. And Victor Robles on Tuesday night had a double, a two-out double in the top of the eighth, but he too failed in a big spot, grounded into a force out for the third out with the bases loaded in the top of the third. And yes, another instance of a Nats fail with the bases loaded this season. Robles for the game left four men on base. But the Nats did win. They are rising. And game two at the Phillies Wednesday afternoon at 1:05, off taking 3 of 4 from the National League East leading Mets, the Nats have a chance here to author a two-game sweep at the Phillies. I mean, what a run this has been for the Nats, not just, you know, going back a few weeks now, but just over these last potentially six games, if the Nats can come through with the win on Wednesday afternoon. And looky, looky who the Nats starting pitcher will be on Wednesday afternoon, Eric Fetty. Are the Phillies ready for Fetty, who himself is surging right now? Eric Fetty has thrown 20 consecutive scoreless innings. Eric Fetty, over his last nine starts, has an ERA of 2.54. He'll be opposing Vince Velasquez, who has a 4.44 ERA over 14 games, including 10 starts this season. You know, actually, Velasquez is kind of like the Phillies' version of Fetty, a guy who was supposed to be good, but it's never really clicked for him. Well, it's clicking now for Fetty. It's never really happened for Velasquez, and hopefully the Nats keep that going on Wednesday afternoon. But man, Fetty and what he's done lately, can't say enough about that. If he keeps it going on Wednesday afternoon, just another reason to buy into Eric Fetty actually finally blossoming as a quality starting pitcher at the major league level. But whatever happens in Wednesday's game two, gonna be hard to top the drama and the tension that was on display in all kinds of ways on Tuesday night. All right, we on Tuesday night had the 2021 NBA draft lottery. The Detroit Pistons won the lottery. They have the number one overall pick in the 2021 NBA draft, which will take place on July 29th. In Brooklyn. In fact, four of the top five picks in what appears to be a loaded draft belong to Eastern Conference teams. Pistons have the first pick, Cleveland Cavaliers have the third pick, Toronto Raptors have the fourth pick, Orlando Magic has the fifth pick. The Western Conference has been better than the Eastern Conference forever. I'm not going to call this a turning point, but if the East is ever going to become better than the West for any substantial period of time, something like this, you figure, has to happen. A bunch of Eastern Conference teams get a bunch of high picks in a loaded draft, and maybe that finally turns things around. I have never understood, though, why the NBA isn't more open to open seeding. I always hear, well, these things are cyclical. You know, sometimes this conference is better. Sometimes that conference is better. Here we are now, 2 decades plus, the West has been better than the East. Let me know when that changes. But yes, 4 of the top 5 picks in this perceived to be loaded 2021 NBA draft belong to Eastern Conference teams. The Wizards, as you likely know, were not a part of the NBA draft lottery on Tuesday night. This was because the Wizards were the number 8 seed in the Eastern Conference in this year's NBA playoffs, and so the Wizards are locked into having the number 15 overall pick in the 2021 draft. Knowing what you now know, would you trade the Wizards having made the playoffs for being in the draft lottery on Tuesday night? My answer in theory is yes, because, you know, the playoff appearance didn't accomplish much and may ultimately not mean anything. But here's the thing. If you know your Wizards slash Bullets history, you know that no team has been done dirtier by the NBA draft lottery than our Bullets slash Wizards.
The damn Washington Wizards!
Yes, that team. The Wizards slash Bullets history in the NBA draft lottery is atrocious. The NBA draft lottery started in 1985. The Wizards slash Bullets have participated in the NBA draft lottery 21 times. The team has received a pick better than the team's pre-lottery position just 3 out of the 21 times. Yes, 3 out of the 21 times. That's it. The Wizards slash Bullets have stayed where they were 8 times. The Wizards slash Bullets have fallen 10 times. So the Wizards slash Bullets all time, essentially, are 3, 10, and 8 in the NBA draft lottery. Let me repeat that. 3, 10, and 8.
The damn Washington Wizards!
And I get that what has happened to a team in the past in NBA draft lotteries has no bearing on what happens to that team in future NBA draft lotteries. But if you're a lifelong Wizards slash Bullets fan like I am, it's hard to ignore this stuff. The 3 times that the Wizards moved up in a draft via the lottery did not exactly result in banner selections either. 2001, the Wizards had the 3rd worst record in the NBA, got the number 1 pick, and took Kwame Brown. 2010, the Wizards had the 5th worst record in the NBA, got the number 1 pick, and took John Wall. 2013, the Wizards had the 8th worst record in the NBA, got the number 3 pick, and took Otto Porter Jr. Wall was good, but flawed. Otto was pretty good, but not great, and the max contract was a mistake. Kwame, of course, was a bust. But the falls for the Wizards slash Bullets in NBA draft lotteries have been many. 1993, the Bullets had the 3rd worst record in the NBA, got the number 6 pick, and took Calbert Chaney. 1995, the Bullets had the 2nd worst record in the NBA, got the number 4 pick, and took Rasheed Wallace. Kevin Garnett went at number 5 to the Minnesota Timberwolves. 2004, the Wizards had the 3rd worst record in the NBA, got the number 5 pick, and technically took Devin Harris, but they quickly traded his draft rights and Jerry Stackhouse and Kristen Laettner to the Dallas Mavericks for Antoine Jameson, and cash considerations, what ended up being a very good trade for the Wizards. 2009, the Wizards had the 2nd worst record in the NBA and got the number 5 pick. Our guy Ernie Grunfeld traded that number 5 pick in the 2009 draft. Alexei Petrov, who Ernie had taken with the number 18 pick in the 2006 NBA draft, Darius Sungaila, and Etan Thomas to the Minnesota Timberwolves for Randy Foy and Mike Miller. Foy played for the Wizards for just 1 season, the 2009-2010 season, before leaving as a free agent and signing with the Los Angeles Clippers in July 2010. Miller played for the Wizards for just that 2009-2010 season before leaving as a free agent and signing with the Miami Heat in July 2010. He ended up winning back-to-back NBA titles with the Heat in 2012 and 2013. 2011, the Wizards had the 4th worst record in the NBA, got the number 6 pick, and took Jan Vesely. The Wizards, as you may recall, had 2 picks in the first round in the 2011 NBA draft, numbers 6 and 18. Ernie took Vesely at 6 and Chris Singleton at 18. each guy became a king of the DNPCD. Did not play, coach's decision. Vesely's NBA career lasted for just 4 seasons. Singleton's NBA career lasted for just 3 seasons. But the killer aspect of that disastrous Wizards 2011 draft is who the Wizards could have taken. Kemba Walker was taken at number 9. Klay Thompson was taken at number 11. Kawhi Leonard was taken at number 15. Nikola Vucevic was taken at number 16. All these guys who the Wizards could have had, and instead, the Wiz went Vesely at 6 and then Singleton at 18.
The damn Washington Wizards!
Yes, exactly. But nothing to me is worse in terms of the Wizards falling in an NBA draft lottery than what happened just a few years ago, 2019. Because a lot of what I just outlined has to do also with who the Wizards ended up taking in those NBA drafts. In 2019, the NBA draft lottery did the Wizards about as dirty as you can be done. The Wizards had the 6th worst record in the NBA. Due to some revamped NBA draft lottery rules, had a 9% chance of landing the number 1 pick and a 37% chance at a top 5 pick. And yet the Wizards got the number 9 pick. This was nearly the worst case scenario. The Wizards had just a 3.8% chance of falling to the 9th spot, and yet that's exactly what ended up happening. Now, the Wizards used the pick on Rui Hachimura. He isn't great, but I think he's been pretty good, and I don't hate that pick at all. I actually like that pick. I think Tommy Shepard did a nice job with that pick. But man, you had a 3.8% chance of falling to the 9 spot, and yet that's exactly what happened to the Wizards in that 2019 NBA draft lottery. So, would the Wizards have been better off being in the draft lottery on Tuesday night than losing in 5 games to the Philadelphia 76ers in the first round of the NBA playoffs? Sure. But given the Wizards / Bullets lottery history, to say nothing of the total crapshoot that is the NBA draft, I can live with this.
The damn Washington Wizards!
That's right. Well, the Orioles now are halfway there. Halfway where? Halfway there. Halfway to yet another 100-loss season. The O's lost to the Houston Astros at Oriole Park at Camden Yards 3-1 on Tuesday night. The O's, since their 15-16 start to the season, are 8-34. 8-34. 34 losses in 42 games. And the O's now are an American League worst 23-50 with an AL worst run differential of minus 92. But 50 losses now. Halfway to 100. Halfway to a C note. What would be a third consecutive 100-loss season in terms of 162-game seasons. Forget about the 2020 season. And keep in mind, the O's have been losing well over 100 games in these recent seasons. 2018, the O's went 47-115. 2019, the O's went 54-108. Now that's losing. Forget about losing 100 games or 101 games. The O's have lost 115-108 games in recent seasons, and the team is tracking toward 111 losses this season. If you're going to tank, this is how you do it. The O's are putting on a masterclass in tanking. Just nothing happening offensively for the Orioles on Tuesday night. 1 run on 6 hits and a walk. The 6 hits were a double and 5 singles. The O's were dominated by Zach Greinke, 1 run in 7 3rd innings. And that's the thing. The Astros are a great team. Former Nationals manager Dusty Baker and his Astros are rolling. They now have won 9 consecutive games, now are an AL best 45-28 with a major league best run differential of plus 122. The bright spot for the O's, though, was their starting pitcher. Believe it or not, Jorge Lopez on Tuesday night did a really good job against the best offense in the majors, in that of the Astros. The Astros entered games on Tuesday number 1 in the majors by miles in team-weighted runs created plus at 125. The Los Angeles Dodgers were number two, but at 112. Lopez on Tuesday night had one of his best starts of the season. I couldn't get over this. Two runs in six into third innings on six strikeouts versus five hits and two walks on 95 pitches, 61 strikes versus 34 balls. The five hits that he allowed, a homer, a double, and three singles. And I don't know where this came from. I mean, Lopez does kind of do this, though, where like every, I don't know, three or four starts, he puts something out there like what he did on Tuesday night that makes you say, all right, you know, maybe there is something to this guy. And then he goes right back to struggling. But Lopez in his previous outing, which came in the Orioles' 10-3 loss at the Cleveland Indians last Thursday afternoon, five runs in four and a third innings on three homers. Lopez entered his start on Tuesday night with an ERA of 5.95 over 14 starts this season. And then he goes out there and he does as he did against the mighty Astros. Again, two runs in six and a third innings on six strikeouts. Game three for the O's against the Stros, Wednesday night at 7:05. Thomas Eshelman versus Jose Urquidy. All right, that will do it for you and me. But just for now, keep the feedback coming. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, thealgaldipodcast@yahoo.com. On Thursday's installment of the podcast, a special guest, Chargers insider Jeff Miller of the Los Angeles Times. He just wrote an article that has received a lot of attention. The article about former Washington quarterback Colt Brennan, who tragically died on May 11th at the age of 37. Sad topic, but a really good piece. We'll also have game two of the Nationals' big and now contentious two-game series at the Philadelphia Phillies to get into. Does Sticky Stuff Gate rear its ugly head again? We shall see. Have a great rest of your Wednesday. I'll talk to you on Thursday.
I want to say three cheers. It's going to be a hip hip, and I want a hooray. Okay? Three cheers. Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip! Hooray!
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.